Right. Now, there are many different ways of studying the Bible. The customary way, of course, in our country now for many years has been to study small portions every day. This is the basis of the Scripture Union notes, etc., and many other notes, of taking a few verses and following through a whole book in that way. Well, that's a method that God has honored, and many of us have been blessed in that way. Another method, which Murray McShane in the last century advocated, was to read four chapters a day, and he had a scheme whereby if you read these four chapters every day, it meant that you would go through the whole Bible in the year, you'd go through the New Testament twice, and you go through the Old Testament once. But even so, there is another method of studying the Bible, not instead of these methods, but in addition to these methods, and that is to read through a whole book at one sitting. When you receive a letter from a friend, do you read three lines today, three lines tomorrow, and finish it in a fortnight's time? It's unnatural, isn't it? So Paul's letters and Peter's letters were intended to be read in one go. They were read in the church. Copies were passed around and they were read right through. And if you read a book of the scriptures right through over and over and over again, you'll grasp it as a book. Now, I fear that Christians in our country today have not been taught to study the Bible like that. And this is why, although they know certain verses and know certain paragraphs, very seldom do they know a whole book as a book. But they were written as complete books and were intended to be understood as a complete book, to see the theme running right through it. Now, this is what we're going to do tonight, is to have a bird's eye view of the book of Deuteronomy. But before we do so, I want you to notice one statement in the Acts of the Apostles and keep this as a kind of text before your eyes this evening. It comes from Stephen's speech, the speech he preached before he was martyred. And you remember that in that speech, he gave a bird's eye view of the whole history of the Jewish people. And when he comes to the reference to Moses in verse 20, he says this in chapter 7 of Acts, verse 20 to 22. At that time, Moses was born, and he was no ordinary child. For 3 months he was cared for in his father's house. When he was placed outside, Pharaoh's daughter brought him up and raised him as her own son. Now the verse I want you to notice particularly is verse 22. Acts chapter 7, verse 22. Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was powerful in speech and action. Now that statement is very, very important for our study tonight. Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was powerful in speech and action. Now I want to show you this map of the empires in the days of Moses. Now, maybe some of you are not very used to looking at maps. Here is the eastern Mediterranean Sea and the island of Cyprus, which was called Elijah. Strange, same name as the prophet, called Elijah in those days, and also called Kittim. Here is Palestine, Israel, but it was part of the Empire of Egypt. So the Empire of Egypt extended from the north all the way down here and then went down into Egypt down here. The River Nile, of course, is a very long river. Here you just see the delta where it comes to the sea. Here was the Sinai Peninsula. Here is the land that you call Israel today. Here on the other side of the River Jordan is the land you call Jordan. Up here is the land you call Lebanon. Over here is the land you call Syria. So all that was part of the Egyptian Empire. Now remember that there have been many phases in the history of Egypt. And at the time that Moses was born, he had entered into about the third golden era. A highly civilized country. The Pharaoh employed hundreds of scribes who spoke many languages. There was a great deal of diplomacy, and there were other empires. You see, bordering the Egyptian empire here was the Hittite empire. This sprawls across what we call eastern Turkey. See, Turkey comes to an end over there, jutting out into the Aegean Sea. Here's the Black Sea up above there. Over here you have another empire called the Urartian Empire. And over here is your Caspian Sea, and you're dealing here, of course, with southern parts of modern Russia. Here was another empire called Mitanni, very powerful empire, a great civilization. And here, incorporated in it, was what later came to be known as the Assyrian Empire. Down here was another empire, Babylonia, which included Elam. Now, all these squiggles here are not just spiders crawled over the page. They are rivers. The main river is the Euphrates. Now, look at the length of this river. It goes for a couple of thousand miles, starting in what we would call Russia, coming into what we call Turkey, and then down through Iran and Iraq. Here's this great sprawling river, and coming to the Persian Gulf at that point. Now notice today, the Persian Gulf starts there. This dotted line here is the ancient coastline. By today, the river Euphrates has carried down so much mud and soil, it has filled up this part of the Gulf, and what used to be sea is now land. Then the other great river is the Tigris River, starting here and coming down here, and also coming into this Persian Gulf. Notice the Euphrates and the Tigris came into the Gulf near to one another. By today, they've joined one another. The two rivers today join one another round about here and flow as one river into the Persian Gulf. Now, where you get all these rivers beginning, these are high mountains. So you've got great mountain ranges around here, and you've got your division of the mountains, the sort of the watershed is at that point. So rivers this side flow down this side of the mountain, rivers that side flow down into the Caspian Sea. Now, the fact there are so many rivers meant that this area was very fertile. So the very fertile areas were the valley of the Nile, the valley of the Euphrates, the valley of the Tigris, etc. So this became known as the Fertile Crescent. In between you had Arabia, which was a desert. So when people travelled, they didn't often travel across that way. It was hot, dusty, and dangerous. They came across in this way, in the shape of a crescent moon, didn't they? So you see, it's the Fertile Crescent. You came up the Persian Gulf, up the valleys of the Euphrates and the Tigris, around the top, and down this way, and down into Egypt. Now, there was much coming and going between Egypt and these empires. A tremendous amount of trade. Sometimes there was fighting. And this is why the Egyptians had conquered Canaan. They wanted to push their boundary as far north as they could, because they had on one occasion been conquered by certain people, and they didn't want it to happen again. So there they were, glowering at the Hittite Empire, trading where they could, fighting where they couldn't. Well, now, that was the situation. Now, in that situation, Moses was brought up. And he was brought up in the Pharaoh's court. So he was given the education that the princes received. Now the Pharaoh, of course, would have many wives, and therefore he'd have many, many sons. He'd have scores of sons and daughters. And these sons would be used as diplomats. They would be, you see, that the heir to the throne would be a special person, but all the others would be given jobs to do in the civil service. So that Moses would have been given a job in the civil service. And he would have been trained not only in the Egyptian language, but in the language of Hittites, the Mitannis, Babylon, etc. He would be a man who would be well versed in these ancient languages. Now, all that is very important when you come to see the life of Moses, because not only was he a born leader, but he was a trained leader. And this is how he was able to lead over a quarter of a million of Israelites, who were not easy to deal with. There were 600,000 of them coming out of Egypt. All that generation, except for a few, died out in this awful Sinai wilderness, and the new generation arose. Now, the book of Deuteronomy is written for the second generation. When Moses died on the borders of Canaan, on this side of the River Jordan. Remember, they came round. We look at a more detailed map of Egypt and this area at another time. But they came round this way, and they approached Canaan from this direction. When Moses died, he was speaking in the book of Deuteronomy to the children of the people that he'd been brought up with. Apart from some of the Levites, only Joshua and Caleb were men in their 80s. All the others had died under God's punishment for their idolatry and disobedience. So that the book of Deuteronomy is the old man Moses, of 120 years of age, looking back over his long life, over the way in which God has dealt with the nation, the way in which the nation has been disobedient, the way in which the nation has also been repentant. And he tells the people now, look, learn from history, learn from recent history. So the book of Deuteronomy, therefore, is a revision of the history of what has happened and the laws brought up to date. You see, the laws that were given in Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers were for people that were wandering in the wilderness. But they were no longer going to wander. They were going to settle in the land of Canaan. And so some of these laws had to be adapted for a settled life. And this is what you get in the book of Deuteronomy. Well, so much, therefore, for a brief look at the world in which Moses lived. Now, I'm going to put something on the overhead projector which may at first sight seem to you to be of no relevance at all. You say, what has this got to do with Deuteronomy? Sorry, it's the other one, Mark. I made a mistake. Thank you. Now, if you look at the title here, Late Second Millennium. Now, don't get confused. Second millennium means from the year 2000 BC to the year 1000 BC, right? We are 2000 years almost now after Christ, aren't we? Now, the period before Christ, 2000 years BC, and coming nearer to us, 1000 years BC. Now, the period in between is called the second millennium, and during the late second millennium, that is the 14th and 13th centuries BC, certain covenants were drawn up between nations. Now, as the Egyptians conquered various nations, they made those nations into vassal states, and they imposed upon them a treaty, and they had to keep that treaty. Now, the Hittites did the same. Now, the archaeologists in the last 100 years have discovered the covenant treaties of the Hittites. The interesting thing was that until the last 100 years, people didn't know about the existence of the Hittites. They were only mentioned in the Bible, and many so-called clever Bible scholars who didn't believe the Bible said the Bible was wrong. Who are these Hittites? Well, now we've discovered their language. Their language has been deciphered. We discovered that they were a high civilization. They had many, many civilized laws. Well, the Hittites imposed these covenants on other people that they conquered. And 25 of those covenants have been discovered and have been translated. And this is their pattern. And you'll see the purpose of why I'm doing this in a moment. Their covenants started with a title or a preamble in which the author of the covenant is named. You know, I, King so-and-so of the Hittites, you know, I'm writing this and telling you what you should do. And then the king would give a historical prologue. All the good things I did for you. Well, of course, he's conquered them. He's massacred some of them. And so they dare not say you're a thug. They have to say, yes, you know, you've done a lot of good things for us. We benefit from your rule. Well, he would say how they benefited. So he would look back on earlier relationships between the overlord, that's himself, and the vassal. And he would say, you were disobedient, and I clobbered you, and now you've learned your lesson. But usually, it was the benefits that the vassal had received from his superior overlord. Then the third section would be certain stipulations. There'd be some general ones, general principles. These would be obligations, you know, you are supposed to obey me and serve me and help me when I'm in need and so on and so forth. And then there'd be very detailed ones, which would include taxation and various things that they had to do and providing sacrifices for the gods of the king in his temple, all these detailed stipulations. Then a copy, deposition, a copy of this covenant was to be deposited in the vassal's temple. And he was to have a copy in that royal temple. Public reading. Every so often, that covenant was to be read to all the people of the conquered nation. They were to gather representatives of all the people together, and the covenant was to be read to them, to be reminded of their obligation to their new king. And a long list of witnesses would be given, and these, of course, were pagan gods. List of the names of the gods of the vassal and the gods of the overlord. These are witnesses that you are to keep this particular treaty. And then there'd be a long list of curses. The curses would be invoked upon the vassal if he breaks the covenant, and blessings invoked if he keeps the covenant. Now, those were the main elements. Now, we gather from insinuation, we gather that there were other items as well. That there was, for example, a solemn oath undertaken, a formal oath of obedience, where the vassal, his ruler, and the officials of the country who had been conquered, they would take this solemn oath to obey the terms of the covenant. Then there'd be a solemn ceremony, in which all this was underlined and you went through the ceremony and made your promises. And then a formal procedure was set up for punishing you if you disobeyed, and you knew what kind of punishment was coming. Now, what has that got to do with Deuteronomy? Now, remember that Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. So he would have known these covenants. He might have been responsible for drawing up some of these covenants on behalf of the Egyptian Pharaoh. We do not know. We have to just assume that if he was brought up in the court circles, he would have met ambassadors from the Hittites and from Mitanni and from Babylonia, and he'd be quite au fait with all the intricacies of diplomacy. And therefore part of his education would be to study covenants of this kind, to understand them and the laws of the various countries. You see, Egypt was not a backwater. It was the hub of the universe. And all these things were very, very important aspects of Moses' training. Now, if we look at the other one, what I want you to notice is this, that Deuteronomy is the same pattern. The same pattern. It is a covenant treaty between Yahweh, that is the name of God, Jehovah, and the people of Israel. It starts off with a preamble. Now, we can't read through all these chapters tonight, but we'll just look at one or two items. If you look at the book of Deuteronomy now then, and look at the opening words, it starts off by telling you who's written the covenant. Now, first verse. These are the words Moses spoke to all Israel in the desert east of the Jordan. Verse 3. In the 40th year, on the first day of the 11th month, Moses proclaimed to the Israelites all that the Lord had commanded him. Ah, so the author of the covenant is the Lord. And Moses is his spokesman, or Moses is his scribe. Moses is writing the covenant on behalf of God. The sort of thing he might have done in the court of Egypt on behalf of the Pharaoh in some kind of covenant with some tribe or district that the Pharaoh had conquered. Therefore, he says, verse 4, this was... He says, when it occurred, it was after the Israelites had conquered these two kings of the Ammonites, a man called Sihon, a man called Og. So that's the introduction. First five verses is the preamble, identifying the author as being God and Moses as his spokesman. Now from verse 6 to the end of chapter 3. And the NIV is useful as having little headings, isn't it? What have you got? You've got historical prologue. Moses recounts what God has done for Israel. You get the appointment of leaders. You get the story of the spies sent out to examine the land of Canaan. You're told of how the spies brought back a false report. Now, this is history now, isn't it? Of what happened in the previous generation 40 years before. And how the people of Israel rebelled and didn't obey God, and so they were punished by having to stay in the wilderness for 40 years. So chapter 2 recounts the wanderings in the wilderness during the 40 years. Chapter 3 speaks of the defeat of Og, king of Bashan, and the division of the land among 2.5 tribes of Israel on the east side of Jordan. And then Moses humbly speaks of his own sin and how God forbade him to come into the land of Canaan himself. Now all that is a recapitulation, a revision in the first 3 chapters. That fits in with a historical prologue of the covenants. Recounts what God has done for Israel, Israel's disobedience from Mount Horeb, which is another word for Sinai, until they arrived at the River Jordan, the borders of Canaan. Now, chapters 4 to 11, these are general laws. And if you've got your NIV, general law in the beginning of chapter 4, the title, Obedience Commanded. Then further on in the chapter, verse 15, Idolatry Forbidden. And then verse 32, The Lord is God, so you worship Him only. Then there's a reference to cities of refuge for those who kill somebody accidentally. Then there's a brief introduction to the law, followed in chapter 5 with the Ten Commandments. And chapter 6, general rules about loving the Lord your God. And chapter 7, driving out the nations. Again, the warning in chapter 8, do not forget God. Chapter 9, God is blessing you, not because you deserve it. And there's the story of the golden calf and the disobedience and how they were rebuked by God. And then in chapter 10, another copy of the Ten Commandments instead of the first ones that were broken by Moses. Then the command to fear the Lord in verse 12 of chapter 10 onwards. And chapter 11, love and obey the Lord. Now all those are general rules, you see, general principles. And then you enter into detailed stipulations. God's requirements of Israel. God is the emperor. God is the Lord. And he is laying down these laws on his vassal. You see this? You see the pattern? You see the difference as well? It isn't that that God is a tyrant like the Pharaoh was. God is a loving God. He has chosen the people of Israel. He's brought them into communion with himself. But he is God. And they are his servants. And they must obey him out of love and thankfulness. Now, what does he expect of them? Well, chapter 12, when they conquer the land of Canaan, there is to be one temple in one place only, not a multiplicity of sanctuaries, the one place of worship. Then, in chapter 13, you mustn't worship other gods. Chapter 14, detailed laws about clean and unclean food, what animals you are to kill and eat, and which ones you are not. A law about tithes, giving a certain percentage of your crops to the Lord. Followed by the year in which people's debts could be cancelled every 7 years. Setting servants or slaves free. The firstborn of your animals must be sacrificed. Then in chapter 16, you have the 3 great religious festivals. Passover, Feast of Weeks, or Feast of Pentecost, and Feast of Tabernacles. So you get details. You see the detailed stipulations. And so you go on. Chapter 17, how law courts are to be conducted. If you have a king, how he is to conduct himself. Chapter 18, what sacrifices must the priests and Levites offer? What detestable practices must you avoid? And then a promise at the end of chapter 18 that God will raise up a mighty prophet one day, and that is a prophecy of Christ. further details in chapter 19 about cities of refuge for the one who accidentally kills his neighbor, and then laws regarding going to war in chapter 20, atonement in chapter 21 for a murder. If you find a body on the ground, you don't know who killed the person, well, how are you going to cleanse the ground from the blood that has soaked into it? And what you do if you capture women in war, are you allowed to marry them and how do you treat them? Now, these are practical laws relating to life as it was in those days. The rights of the firstborn to inherit, how do you deal with a rebellious son? All that you get in chapter 21. And then various laws into chapter 22 and what happens when a marriage is violated, adultery, rape, etc. Well, rules regarding that. And who is not allowed to come to the tabernacle or temple of God? You're told that in chapter 23. Variety of laws again at the end of chapter 23 and whole of chapter 24 and 25. And then in chapter 26, laws of bringing the first fruits of your crops as a tithe unto God. And this brings you now up to the end of that division, chapters 12 to 26, detailed laws, detailed stipulations, the obligations that God places on Israel. Now, at this point, there's a diversion between Deuteronomy and the Book of the Covenant and the covenants of the ancient treaties, insofar as Moses feels free to alter the order a little bit. And so you jump to chapter 31, and the passage that Wynne read to us at the beginning, you notice how similar that is to the covenant treaties. Chapter 31, verse 9. So Moses wrote down this law and gave it to the priests, the sons of Levi, who carried the ark of the covenant of the Lord, and to all the elders of Israel. And then, in verse 24, after Moses finished writing in a book the words of this law from beginning to end, he gave this command to the Levites who carried the ark of the covenant of the Lord: take this book of the law and place it beside the ark of the covenant of the Lord your God. There it will remain as a witness against you. There's the deposition. You see, it is the laws of the ruler there in your temple. And you can see it. And it's a witness against you if you break this law. Then back in chapter 31, verse 10, then Moses commanded them, at the end of every 7 years, in the year for cancelling debts, during the Feast of Tabernacles in September, October, when all Israel comes to appear before the Lord your God at the place you will choose, you shall read this law. The whole book of Deuteronomy. People will stand or sit there and they will listen to the whole book being read to them. Men, women and children. See, there was no publishing firm in those days. You couldn't go and buy a copy of the book of Deuteronomy and carry it in your breast pocket or something like that. They were mighty big scrolls. And therefore, only the priests would have them. If you wanted one, you had to have the priest to copy one out for you. Now, how long would it take you to write out the book of Deuteronomy? Well, you're not going to make many copies at that rate, are you? Well, here you see, therefore, that it was important that people should come and hear the word of God. And this was done. Then the work of the Levites was to teach the people. Throughout the 7 years, they would be teaching them. And then every 7 years, people would come and hear the words read once more. There's the deposition of the text. Now, and the public reading of the covenant. Now, what about the witnesses? Now, in the book of Deuteronomy, of course, the gods of paganism are excluded. So who are the witnesses? Well, there are a variety of them. Go back to chapter 27 and verses 2 to 4. When you've crossed the Jordan, says Moses, into the land the Lord your God is giving you, set up some large stones and coat them with plaster. Write on them all the words of this law when you've crossed over to enter the land the Lord your God is giving you, a land flowing with milk and honey, just as the Lord, the God of your fathers, promised you. And when you've crossed the Jordan, set up these stones on Mount Ebal, as I command you today, and coat them with plaster. So you could go to Mount Ebal and read the law, couldn't you? That was another thing. That would be a memorial stone, and that would be a witness. You can imagine a child asking his father, "What are these stones, Dad?" And he said, he'd tell the story. They are memorial stones of what we did when we conquered the land and crossed the River Jordan, and it was done at God's command through his servant Moses. So that would be one witness. Now, then in chapter 30, verse 19, you have Moses calling upon heaven and earth to be witnesses. Now, this was a dramatic way of saying, there's a day of judgment. God will remind you that you know this law. Then the Lord, where are we now? Chapter 30, verse 19. This day I call heaven and earth as witnesses against you that I have set before you life and death, blessings and curses. Now choose life, so that you and your children may live, and that you may love the Lord your God, listen to his voice, and hold fast to him, for the Lord is your life, and he will give you many years in the land he swore to give to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So heaven and earth is called upon to witness to this gracious covenant that God is making with the people that he has chosen, the people of Israel. Then the third witness, of course, is the law book itself, isn't it? In chapter 31, verse 26, take this book of the law, place it beside the Ark of the Covenant. And finally, there's the Song of Moses, which you get in chapter 32. Go back to chapter 31, verse 19. Now write down, God says, write down for yourselves this song and teach it to the Israelites and make them sing it so that it may be a witness for me against them. And then the last verse of chapter 31. And Moses recited the words of this song from beginning to end in the hearing of the whole assembly of Israel. And the whole chapter 32 then, a long chapter as you see, contains this song, which continues down to verse 43. And it is a song of praise unto God, and also of a reminder of how the people of Israel corrupted themselves against God. Jeshurun, the name for Israel, kicked in rebellion, and God rebuked them and brought calamities upon them. And then God has compassion on them again and restores them. So the song is a witness. Now this brings us to point number six here, blessings and curses. Now in the covenants made by these Hittites, the cursings came first. But in the scriptures, the blessings come first. And Moses said, when you conquer the land of Canaan and cross into across the Jordan, you are to pronounce blessings from one mountain and curses from another mountain. Now chapter 28 is where these are contained. Chapter 28. Blessings for obedience. From verse 1 to the end of verse 14, and then verses 15 to the end of the chapter, curses for disobedience. And they were told that if you go back at chapter 27, verse 12, when you've crossed the Jordan, certain tribes shall stand on Mount Gerizim to bless the people. And he names the tribes. Verse 13, these other tribes shall stand on Mount Ebal to pronounce curses. So you've got six tribes standing on one mountain range, and the other tribes standing on the other mountain range, and they shout to one another across the valley. And one is shouting out blessings if they obey, and the others are shouting out curses if they disobey. Now all those elements points 1 to 6 there are exactly as you find in these covenant treaties of the Hittite Empire, except that Moses reverses the order here and there as he sees fit. But in addition, you get written in the book of Deuteronomy certain things that we only could insinuate in these covenant treaties. If you look at chapter 27, you have a solemn oath undertaken by the people of Israel. It begins in verse 14. The Levites shall recite to all the people of Israel in a loud voice, "Cursed is the man who carves an image or casts an idol," and you get certain other curses, and everybody says, "Amen." The significance of that is that everybody agrees. They are making an oath. "Cursed is the man who carves an image or an idol," and people say, "Amen. We pledge ourselves not to make an idol." And from that verse 15 to the end of the chapter, you have the people saying "Amen" after every one of these curses. Now that's a solemn oath, a solemn promise in the presence of God that they will be obedient. If you come to chapter 29, you have Moses giving them a very serious pep talk, in which he renews the covenant that had been broken by the fathers of this generation. And in the opening verses of chapter 29, these are the terms of the covenant the Lord commanded Moses to make with the Israelites in Moab, in addition to the covenant he made at Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb. Moses summoned all the Israelites and said, "Your eyes have seen all the Lord did in Egypt to Pharaoh." Now remember that people who were under 21 when the people of Israel were disobedient, their lives were spared. So there were some men who had been born in Egypt. They were only little toddlers when they came out of Egypt, but they remembered Egypt. And they remembered the crossing of the Red Sea. And he said, "Now your eyes have seen what the Lord did to Pharaoh, how he brought you through the Red Sea. You've seen his miraculous signs in the wilderness. You've seen how your fathers were disobedient and how they died under various plagues in the wilderness. So you remember these things." So he puts them into a position of challenge. Says, "Now look, are you going to repeat the mistakes of your fathers? Or are you going to dedicate yourself now unto the Lord?" So it's a very solemn ceremony that you've got in the 29th chapter, where he appeals to them to give themselves unto the Lord completely. And he ends with that very famous verse in verse 29 that I'm very often fond of quoting. "The secret things belong unto the Lord our God, but the things revealed belong unto us and to our children forever, that we may follow all the words of this law." Why has God revealed his covenant? "In order that you might follow the words of this law." And then in chapter 30, he puts the question to them and calls them to make a decision, to make a solemn decision now. There'll be prosperity if you follow the Lord. You see, the offer of life or death. Verse 11, "Now what I am commanding you today is not too difficult for you or beyond your reach. It is not up in heaven, so that you have to ask who will ascend into heaven to get it and proclaim it to us. Nor is it beyond the sea, so that anyone will have to cross the sea. No," he says in verse 14, "the word is very near you. It is in your mouth and in your heart, so that you may obey it." So he presses them to decide to follow the Lord. Now, what's the Old Testament equivalent for God's punishment for those who disobey? Well, it begins in chapter 32 with that song of Moses, where there are warnings. But it is carried on throughout the rest of the Old Testament, because all the prophets write in what we call a Deuteronomic style of writing. The prophets were soaked in the book of Deuteronomy, and they knew it. And the style of Deuteronomy came out in their sermons. And the prophets who warned Israel and Judah of disaster if they continued in sin, they are the ones that are equivalent to the threats made in the Hittite covenants, you see. The Old Testament equivalent for the procedure that the emperor would take against a faithless vassal, disobedient vassal, begins in chapter 32, continues in the warnings of the prophets throughout the remainder of the Old Testament. Well, that's a quick bird's eye view of the book. No doubt you will feel rather exhausted. Malcolm says that he can produce a copy of what's been on the overhead projector to go with the tip. So that may be a help.
Maybe not the map.
Pardon?
Maybe not the map.
Maybe not the map, no, right? Or, well, there we are. Here you see then a span of the whole book. Now, the question I'm asking you is this. What do you learn about God from that? Because that's the basis of every Bible study, isn't it? What do you learn about God from that? Well, pause and think for a moment.
He's just.
He's just, yes. He's Lord, isn't he? He's Lord. The awesomeness of God. We can't play fast and loose with God. Nobody could play fast and loose with the emperor of the Hittites, or with the emperor of Egypt, or the emperor of Babylon, or the emperor of Mitanni. It would cost you your life. They were tyrants, and you couldn't disobey them. They brooked no disobedience at all. But they were unjust. But we are dealing with the Lord of glory, and he has rights, and he has in love chosen us. And he has the right to demand our obedience. But his demands are not irksome. His demands are not cruel. But he is Lord. And we've lost this sense of lordship in a democratic country. Everyone has his rights and the trade union rights and all the rest of it. So it's most difficult for us. It wasn't so difficult for people in those days to know what it was to disobey a king. They all knew about that. The executioner was in much demand in all the royal courts, and he had a full-time occupation. There was no question of a trade union. Now, God is in majesty enthroned, and in love he has chosen you and me to be his children. He asks for us to obey him. He commands us to obey him. So by reading through the book of Deuteronomy with that in view, then you can grasp something of the greatness of God and the privilege we have of being his vassal. But he doesn't call us a vassal, he calls you my child. No king of the Hittites or of Egypt or of Mitanni or of Babylon would have called any vassal nation, my child. So you see the differences. Now, what else do you learn about God from the fact that Moses wrote the book in this kind of style? He used a secular style, didn't he? The treaties that were imposed by dictators upon the people that they conquered. And what does that show you, that God inspired Moses to write in that manner? What does it show you about God, and what does it show you about the way in which he uses people? What's the name again?
Phinehas,
that's right. You pardon me, don't you? You know, if it was Evans or Jones, I'd remember. Right, Bill and I met frequently in the Bala conference, and Reverend Bill Fillinor is here on holiday in Pontlovely at the moment. He was with us worshipping on Sunday. Now then, Bill, yes, sorry.
The God condescends to use terms that we are familiar with.
That's right. Mm. That's the interesting thing, isn't it? that he speaks to us in the language of that we understand. Now you say, our world has changed from this age in which Moses lived, and so we need a little commentary to explain it. There's no need to give a commentary in those days. Everybody understood this style of writing. It was the style of that period. But nevertheless, it does show you that God speaks to you in the language of today. And that, I think, is the reason why from time to time it is useful to have updated translations of the Bible. God does speak to us in today's language. Now, if you read through the book of Deuteronomy in the NIV, you'll go through it much more quickly than if you read it in the Authorized Version. For the simple fact, although many of us love the Authorized Version because we've been brought up on it, it still isn't our language. And however familiar you are with the Authorized Version, I doubt if 1 in 1,000 would read through the Authorized Version of Deuteronomy as quickly as they would read through the NIV. And I doubt if they would grasp it entirely as they would in reading it through the NIV. It's just the language of today. What we have to be sure of course, that the translations are worthy. Now let's remember, the Authorized Version was translated by men who believed the Scriptures. But the NIV has been translated by men who believed the Scriptures. Now that's not true entirely of the Revised Standard Version. And it certainly is not true to say, it can be said that people who have given these paraphrases like Good News Bible and Living Bible, that Kenneth Taylor of the Living Bible is a believer. But they've not translated, they've interpreted. They've put it in their own words and have not given you a fair translation. And sometimes their interpretation is not correct. But in the NIV and in the Authorized Version, you've got men who are scholars and who are believers and who have endeavored to translate it correctly. Now, that's one thing. God speaks to you in the language of today. What else? What about the way in which he uses you? Well, do you think he would use you, Terry, to write poetry? Are you a poet?
No.
So you will never write poetry? No, that's it. But he'll use you in another way. But Moses was a diplomat. He was an educated courtier in the Pharaoh's court. And it was the most natural thing for him to use all his scribal training to write this book in the style that was the most majestic style of all, the Sovereign Lord, making a gracious covenant with poor, despised slaves, and saying, I've brought you unto myself on eagle's wings. It's wonderful. It's really marvelous. And you can get something of a grasp of the might of God and the humility of God and the love of God in that way. Is there anything else? Well, what does it say about the way Christians use secular things? Can they be transformed? Can they be transformed? See, nobody would have thought of a vassal treaty like this as being in any way a means of communicating God's truth. But oh, when the Spirit of God comes upon a man like Moses, he uses him, uses his training, uses his method of writing, uses his style of putting things across, and uses him and sees to it that he does not write anything that's in error. So the Spirit of God carries Moses forward and protects him from anything that is humanly sinful from coming out into the Scriptures. And there's a mystery. There's a mystery.